Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're inviting you today to join us while we reminisce, more or less, with some really outstanding women significant in the whole culinary history of America, and I guess France, too, because we start off with Ann Willen, founder of La Varenne.
Let's not forget, of course, that Anne's a fellow countryman of mine. And an alum of my university until she'd adopted America as her home.
Right.
After living for many years in France. Sorry about that.
No, I think that's great that you remembered.
Joyce Goldstein, in the meantime,
was
making a name for herself in the Golden West, in the state of California, where there was obviously a major movement in cuisine that started in the 1960s, and Joyce was fair and square in the middle of it, and tells its story in a most compelling fashion. And then finally, someone who's almost synonymous with vegetarian cuisine, Molly Katzen, who wrote a book, famous book called The Moosewood, something or other.
Yes, The Moosewood Cookbook.
That was years and years and years
Everybody
and years ago.
Everybody at one time
cooked from it. Yeah. So now she's decided that she needed to do another book. It took her 3+ years to do it.
She's very thorough.
once again, the latest and greatest in vegetarian and vegan cuisine in a wonderful cookbook. So that's the agenda. That's the menu, I guess.
Yeah, well, let's launch off Ann Willen, because we love to talk to her all the time.
And this is not appetizer, main course, and dessert, because these ladies are all main course material. We're talking about soufflés with Ann Willen,
but we're not really talking about soufflés.
Ann Willen is a woman of many parts because she knows how you're supposed to serve Yorkshire pudding the genuine way. Now, we won't do that today, and we won't bore everybody with that information, but I'm glad at least you and I know.
Well, it's in the book. We should probably talk about it.
It's in Ann's book? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't read that far.
Why don't we start from the beginning? Because we've talked to Ann before. Ann is, of course, mostly associated with the La Varenne Cooking School, which has molded the culinary scene for years now. Written this with Amy Friedman, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But the book is called One Soufflé at a Time, subtitled A Memoir of Food and France. But I think that it should be subtitled A Really Personal, Up Close Conversation About and With Ann Willen herself. Is that accurate, Ann?
Yes, it is, I hope. I think lots of personal details probably come across, and it certainly isn't a book that I've ever even approached or a way of looking at my life that I've ever approached before.
Well, who talked you into doing it?
Well, it was our daughter who talked me into doing it. She said, "Mum, you're always telling stories. You should write them down. You should do a memoir." I said, "Oh, no, I don't think I could. I'm too English. I can't write about myself." Because we were, of course, always told as children when we were growing up, you should not be thinking about yourself, but always about other people.
And you should be seen and not heard anyway, right?
Well, indeed, you should really be seen and not heard.
We should bring into this scenario here that not only is Ann Willen English, but she's also a Yorkshire person, the same as my husband, and she's also a Cambridge alum, which also Peter is. So you two should be really in love with each other.
Well, we are.
And so there are lots of links, yes.
And I have your wonderful tongue recipe.
And we use that all the time.
Which I make whenever I can lay my hands on any tongue, which is sadly not all that frequently.
They're all shipped out to France. Did you know that?
Is that what happens to the miserable Frenchman? Another reason why we dislike the French, right, Anne?
Well, it possibly is.
Well, Anne doesn't dislike the French. She's one of the world's authorities on French cooking. As I said, she founded the École de Cuisine La Varenne in 1975. There are people coming through your school. It's enough to write any book. You could write just about people coming through your doors.
Well, we've had that conversation before as to how, Anne, you must be a Yorkshire woman. Nobody in their right mind would go to France and say, "I'm an English person and I'm going to found a cooking school to teach people how to cook French."
Well, looking back on it, it was pretty crazy.
Yep.
But at the time, I felt, and I still do feel, if you want to do something, you should try it. When I was starting, how welcoming the French food community was. It was the beginnings of Nouvelle Cuisine, and we would invite the young chefs to come and do classes, and they were astonishingly open to finding a then moderately young female foreigner running the school.
But that's a female too, right?
We all had the same enthusiasm, and I think they enjoyed and respected that. Anyway, I never found prejudice again, possibly a little bit against foreigners, though foreigners don't know anything about French food, but I soon put that to rest, usually. And I did not find any prejudice against being a woman running a business in France.
Now, that's amazing.
Mm.
Now, you approached this with a certain light touch as well as a personal touch. One of my most favorite things was the things I've smuggled in my suitcase.
I hope the statute of limitations is over.
What put you up to doing that one?
Oh, well, actually, oddly enough, it was Emma's husband, so our son-in-law, and he said, you know, you really ought to write it down, because I would say, oh, let's take a bit of this or that whenever we were crossing the Atlantic. And he would say, because he's slightly straight-laced, Todd, he's an American, and he would be quite shocked that I would smuggle these things through past the American customs.
Well, you were bringing them here.
Well, both ways, she said. Yes. There's exotic fruits and vegetables from what is that on the Amazon? Confiscated
by Amazon. That was when I was on the Amazon. Well, that was probably the first time I tried smuggling, and I wasn't aware of how strict the customs are. They kind of laughed. They were very kind customs in Miami, and they just took these fascinating exotic fruits away.
And then you said, I love this, the cunning of it all, Anne. Fresh truffles for Julia Child, packed with camphor balls to distract sniffer dogs.
Well, yes, that is a long, long time ago. but, of course, truffles all pervade almost anything.
You probably had truffle under
there. I put them in my suitcase, and my clothes smelled of truffles for weeks. Not for a night.
Probably not a bad thing to go around smelling of, after all.
Well, I mean, you know, they have a kind of earthy tinge to them that isn't really awfully attractive.
No, that's true.
It's attractive to pigs.
Pigs. And certain dogs that are trained, yes.
That's for the truffles.
Now, let's talk about, you approach different stages of your life and built around your experiences and also the people involved with you at that time. How did you organize that?
Well, I've been lucky enough to find all sorts of wonderful friends, wonderful staff and students. Very much enjoy working with other people who have similar enthusiasm and interest in food. And I absolutely love hearing what they have to say, but of course also trying to pass on my knowledge and, I mean, let's face it, my strong opinion.
You know, you were strong enough to insist that the instructions at La Varenne be bilingual, which was a no-no at the time in French kitchens.
Well, nobody kind of bothered. Nobody had the respect, really, for people who wanted to learn one of the great, great French specialties, French cuisine, particularly classic cuisine, but who could not speak the language.
Now, when you opened, Craig Claiborne visited surprisingly early, right?
Well, I had met Craig a long time before. That was when I was living in New York and working for Gourmet magazine, so that was 10 years before. And so Craig, though not a close friend, was a close professional acquaintance, so he knew who I was. He knew that I was serious, and I think he was intrigued.
And he actually, I guess, gave you a big boost with his reporting in the Times, huh?
Indeed he did. He came, a couple of days before we opened. He was on one of his annual or possibly semi-annual Trips Harris, and he stayed about an hour, and we tasted some good food, and we did a little cooking demonstration. And he was, of course, he was a great expert on food, but a wonderful reporter. And he had a great nose for a good story, and he realized that this was indeed a slightly crazy thing that we were attempting.
Now, you do weave recipes in among these the memoir chapters, and some vintage photographs, which are totally charming. I'm looking at one of your early childhood in the Yorkshire Dales, where your father was born, and you said you were already a very strong-minded child.
Well, I think you can see that in the picture. I mean, one of those little smocked, puff-sleeved dresses and little barred shoes, and I have a kind of carefully arranged little curl on top of my head, and I'm looking down, and I'm set my chin, and I'm looking very determined. Don't you think?
Yes.
Funny picture. That.
It is. It's adorable picture, and of course you have the recipes that go with this part of your life: ginger biscuits, which is,
nice ginger biscuits.
Is absolutely essential. And then what we were talking about before is the roast beef and Yorkshire pudding.
Oh,
how about treacle tart?
Treacle tart is very interesting. It's just three ingredients, and it's golden syrup that you can find here now, but is not familiar to quite a lot of people. A cross between molasses and sugar syrup, so that it's kind of molasses at an earlier stage of refining, and it has a delicious flavor, a bit like honey, and it makes the most lovely tart. It's mixed with squeeze of lemon juice, breadcrumbs to thicken it slightly, and that's it.
Yeah, my mother used to make treacle tart, and we all loved it, of course,
and it's good with ice cream.
Yeah, there you go. But it's good. It's good on toast, I guess. It's good on bread. It's good on everything. And was Tate and Lyle your brand?
Absolutely.
And on the brand it has Samson's Riddle, if you remember. after the strong cometh forth sweetness.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that? You probably do.
And you have
Only
just. I do remember treacle being drizzled on my porridge in the mornings. And if I was a good girl, my mother would shape an A with a spoon.
Aww.
How about that?
You have chapter 3 here, a Yorkshire added. Apple pie without the cheese is like a kiss without the squeeze.
That just hits the nail on the head, doesn't it?
And it's exactly the sort of thing that Peter's mother would say.
It is.
I was just going to say, Peter must know that one.
Well,
favorite of mine.
We didn't used to have cheese with apple pie, but we did have cheese with fruitcake. You had to have cheese with fruitcake.
Now, you started out with an interest in science, and that's, I guess, what you had in mind by going to Cambridge. Do you think that relates at all to your cooking? I mean, there is an affinity, isn't there?
Well, yes, I think so. Science makes you curious about why things do the things that they do. And certainly, though I am far from a food scientist, I'm always curious about just why gravy tastes better when you've really thoroughly reduced the juices in the bottom of the pan, and why Hollandaise sauce emulsifies but won't emulsify unless you get it hot enough to a certain temperature. But if you cook it for too long or cook it too fast, then it curdles. And that's very helpful in cooking.
But what convinced you that you wanted to cook for a living?
Well, I've always loved to eat. And actually, both our children enjoy eating, and our son was born with a feeling for cooking, though he'd not gone into anything to do with cooking. But Simon's one of those people who can look at a pan, and he'll say, I think that's nearly done, Mum, you better come and look at it. When you have a feeling for food, and you've done a certain amount of cooking, you acquire a kind of sixth sense for what things should smell like, and look like, and sound like, and those little putt 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 sucking noises on the stove are enormously informative. And you can hear when water is boiling or when it's just simmering. And it's very helpful.
Now, you had really varied experiences in France. I mean, you were really drawn to the country in a number of different ways, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, we live in a couple of the French regions as well as in Paris. And right from the beginning of the school, I was intrigued by the regional cooking of France. So we made a point. We love traveling anyway, Mark and I, my husband. And we would travel all over France, eating and looking for different dishes and different ingredients.
And you had many historic encounters. How did that come about? Like with the Kennedys and the Duke and Duchess of Windsor?
Not, in fact, with the Kennedys, but right at the beginning of my career in France, when I was studying at the Cordon Bleu in Paris, which revealed a very different and much more in-depth view than teaching that I'd been doing in England, which was also Cordon Bleu. I wanted to get to earn some money because I was in Paris and I had a little bit of money of my own, but not enough. And so I put an ad in the Herald Tribune, which was the English language newspaper of the time and indeed still is for expatriates. And I said, Cordon Bleu cooks for dinner parties and gives cooking lessons. And I got 5 replies. And 2 of them were from American Women's Group, which I had never really come across because I had never been to the States and I had no American friends. So that was a learning and very happy learning experience. There was the counselor at the British Embassy who wanted me to make cocktail canapés for parties. There was a gentleman at the George V Hotel, which was very posh at the time, who wanted me to come and cook an intimate dinner for 2. And scrawled letter headed Chateau de Versailles in handwriting saying, I have Mexican servants and I've married a Frenchman and I need someone to teach the cook French cooking. And I thought, well, this is a joke. But I, on principle, always explore everything. So I drove out in my little MG coupe and was let through the main gate and parked on the left-hand side in front of the El Colbert and talked to a woman who, as I then learned, was very famous in French social circles called Florence van der Kemp.
Oh, yes.
And she was an American married to the curator of Versailles. And she had the money, he had the connection, and they did a lot of official entertaining. Charles de Gaulle, Princess Grace, and Prince Albert of Monaco, those sort of people. I was not invited to the parties. I was in the kitchen at the back, organizing the cook and the maitre d', and it was quite an experience.
Well, it's a grand life that you live, and I wanted to mention again that you thought you were probably not going to be able to write about so many intimate details of your life, but you were helped greatly with Amy Friedman, and that it was, did you say, 2.5 years of meeting? How often?
Well, we met once a week, and Amy has been one of the wonderful experiences of my life. Amy is now a close friend. She's a professional memoir writer, and she sits down with people who want to record their memories and draws out of them what, in my case, far more than I knew I wanted to say. But she was absolutely right in drawing out some very interesting aspects and getting things on paper that sounded like my voice, which is an amazing gift. And the way she does it is she recorded our discussion. We would talk once a week for 2 or 3 hours every week, and then she would go home and transcribe it. And then she picked out the part that she felt were interesting and important and put them all together. And it's a huge amount of work.
It certainly is, yes.
And it was very interesting. No wonder I couldn't manage that.
Well, you two of you managed this wonderful memoir, and I think that people will be fascinated to get behind the Ann Willen that they know from the more standard cookbook and understand the sensibilities of the woman who is Ann Willen. And good luck with this book, and I will wait for the next one before we talk again.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to you both.
You too, Ann. Thank you.
And thank you to the two Anns, Ann Willen and Ann Haig, for such a wonderful conversation. And we'll be back right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I must say that it's been a pleasure over the years to experience Joyce Goldstein's involvement with the food revolution and the book that she's written, The California Food Revolution, 30 Years That Changed Our Culinary Consciousness, it's just an invaluable book for everybody to read. It puts the whole thing of what's happening today in a perspective that otherwise we wouldn't have.
It's also quite an adventure story, too.
Yeah,
a lot of firsts, a lot of things people
it's
thought
lively narrative yeah, too.
People thought it would never happen, and they did. A cast of characters that many of whom are names that you'll recognize if you're into the food and drink business, and here they are all woven together in a coherent story which explains not only what happened but why.
It's no secret how much I admire Joyce Goldstein, and Joyce, I guess we go back quite a ways here. Your book, congratulations on this amazing book called Inside the California Food Revolution. And in fact, it's the inside part that makes this so unique. I mean, there have been plenty of histories of what happened in the California Food Revolution. But you not only viewed it as an insider, you were a protagonist.
Well,
is that the right word?
It was interesting to sort of look back on my history and then all the people that I had worked with and be able to interview them now. You know, I talked to over 200 people, and when I sent out an initial email to everybody saying, I'm writing this book and I'd like to hear about your past in California food history, everybody responded, but I sent a list of all the people I was going to interview, and I kept saying, am I missing anyone? Is there anyone else who should be on this list? And it was wonderful to talk to people because, you know, this story goes back 40 years, and the thought that we're still all friends and involved and active and passionate is very important.
Now, there are some people who sort of disappeared along the way. I'm thinking of Elka Gilmore?
Oh, yeah, Elka.
Who was...
Well, Elka, I think, is no longer in the business. Maybe she's doing some consulting. But, you know, she was one of the first women chefs and also one of the first people up here in Northern California doing fusion cooking, Asian,
French. We mustn't forget Joyce Goldstein was kind of a part of it from the beginning, too, right? don't be modest, Joyce.
No. Well, I mean, we did our part in introducing Mediterranean food to... Well, to Americans, I mean, who I guess thought of it as sort of odd ethnic food, but by putting it on an upscale menu, I think it introduced people to a whole new series of cultures whose food they had not studied before.
If I might just summarize a little bit, is you introduce the subject, which is subtitled 30 Years to Change Our Culinary Consciousness, and it certainly did, that it was an intersection of people, what I call a terroir or climate, entrepreneurial spirit, and the kind of openness you get at being on the West Coast. But your focus in this book is really on the people.
Well, it's on the people who were active, and, I mean, they weren't all just chefs, although we had an army of phenomenal chefs, many of whom were self-taught, did not work in restaurants, did not go to cooking school, We had more women chefs in Northern California than I think in any place in the world. But we also had enterprising farmers. We had artisans who were self-taught. I mean, the first American goat cheese was made here in California. The first artisanal bread, Steve Sullivan and Acme. I mean, before that, all the bread had become automated. None of the people knew how to form loaves by hand anymore. We had people creating charcuterie, Victoria Wise, in 1972. I mean, you think about this. And everybody sort of forged ahead. As we had open kitchens, well, then the dining room changed. The environment changed. You didn't have to whisper in hushed tones. And it became a lot more relaxed. But then service couldn't break down. You still had to have professional service. So a new style of service was developed. Every little change made a big change.
How about wood fire? Who was it who said that was the center of the revolution?
Yeah, the kitchen was very important, and also the design of the kitchen changed. I mean, in the old French kitchens, there were no grills or wood-burning ovens, wood-burning stoves, any of that. And also, the cold station, what we call the pantry, was very small because they weren't doing complicated salads where things had to be heated or coordinated with anyone else on the line. So California also expanded greatly the cold station, too.
Now, let's not leave something important out, because we're going to do a little bit of a history book tour, which is very important. But I think one of the totally fascinating things, and we just got back from California, and the amazing thing about it is that it's still going on. So there are new people stepping up all the time. We dined at a restaurant called Aubergine in Carmel by the Sea in California just a night or two ago. And there's a new young man there called Justin Cogley, who is, if you like, he's continuing the tradition and speaking so proudly of the ingredients that he has available, which is one of the things that you mention a good deal in your book as well, because it wouldn't have been possible if that larder hadn't been there, would it?
Well, exactly. I mean, many of us had traveled abroad, and we saw all these ingredients that we wanted to cook with, and no one had the seeds. No one was growing them here. So we either brought in seeds, and Georgianne Brennan at Le Marché Seeds also brought in the seeds and went out and taught our farmers how to grow some of these things. But, you know, Northern California basically is fascinated by ingredients. Everything we do is fresh, seasonal, local, a huge larder of fresh ingredients. Southern California didn't really become ingredient crazy until probably the last, I'd say, 10 or 15 years ago. They were more interested in style and, you know, modern design and things like that. And also, I think they pioneered sort of fusion cooking down in L.A. We were a little slow to get into that. And I think what was interesting, too, is that fusion and eclectic got confused. Like at Square One, we had an eclectic menu, which meant we could have a dish from Greece, we could have a dish from France, one from Spain, one from Italy, but we didn't fuse them or cross them over. Whereas in Southern California, Wolfgang Puck and some of the chefs there started fusing Asian and French right away. I mean, they would do Japanese or Chinese interpretations, but using French technique and a lot of French ingredients. So we each had our different areas of expertise.
Now you keep sort of slipping over this Square One narrative. And this was a really influential restaurant, the restaurant you started. And what year was it?
What? I beg your pardon?
What year was it?
Oh, we opened in 1984. And right. We were open for 12 years. And I opened a restaurant when I was 50 years old, and I didn't realize that my legs might get tired.
I mean, absolutely. This attitude, is, first of all, I think it's really hard for today's younger generation to understand there was a time when there were none of these ingredients available. Even Jacques Pepin said that when he first came to the U.S., you couldn't buy any mushrooms but button mushrooms.
Exactly. There were no wild mushrooms. We couldn't get fresh herbs. There was no arugula or mash or little tiny green beans or those beautiful multicolored beets or anything organic. I mean, before 1970, none of this stuff was around. So you couldn't have cooked
with it. And the other thing is, so many people, you mentioned it just a little bit ago, I mean, you jumped into this restaurant business probably because you didn't realize how difficult it was going to be.
I never thought it would be hard.
But so many people were self-taught and brave, just brave.
You know, I think in California there is a certain spirit of why not try, why not go for it. And I think so many of us did this, never thinking that it would either be impossible or difficult or that there would be obstacles in our way. And, I mean, the thing that really impressed me the most interviewing people for this book were how many taught themselves. I mean, that's unheard of. Like, on the East Coast, people would never do that. You'd say, well, you can't open a restaurant. You didn't work in one. Or you didn't go to cooking school.
Exactly.
Here, everybody just sort of did it. And it never dawned on us that it was unusual.
You know me, and you know exactly what I'm going to focus in on next, is I was riveted by your discussion of the status of women in the industry today.
It's a changing scene.
Pardon?
It's a changing scene for women.
Well, tell me about it. What is your take on it? I mean, because I felt like I stepped back in time to the first meetings of women chefs and restaurateurs, having to carry on with the people from Cook at Raw that had an entire panel in London on stage, every single one of them a man, except for one who was the translator. And we posed the question, why have no men been ever included in any of these? Why have no women ever been included?
Well, what's happening is, I think, what happened in California, there were hundreds of women chefs, and we all supported each other. But women are very smart and entrepreneurial, and at a certain point they realize they want control of their time. And so many of them branched out and opened their own businesses, whether it was a cheese company or making their preserves or becoming a sommelier or working as a winemaker or a teacher. Women need control of their time if they're going to have a family and be home. But also what's happening is that technique and a lot of this TV stuff, the competition, is getting all the press. And women don't thrive in environments like that. They think competition is sort of stupid and game show television is not something they choose to do.
Yeah, I love your description of the bad boys.
I beg your pardon?
I loved your description.
Boys with toys.
The bad boys.
That's who they
boys.
Are. And yeah. I've been talking to a lot of young women in the culinary schools, and they say, I don't want to work with those guys. That's not what I want to do. Many of them are opening their own catering companies, food to go. They just find that the whole, it's become a boys' club again. It started out as a boys' club, the women broke in, and now it's sort of a boys' club again. And I don't know if that will change, but I do see women going into so many other related fields of food and wine and doing very, very well.
Especially wine. The sommeliers are really, and you know, the interesting thing is we interviewed people from a section in Spain, where over 50% of the winemakers were women.
Yes, well, that's what's happening. And I think it's very exciting. And so I don't feel women have dropped out of our field. I just think that they have found a way to make it work for them if they want to have a more rounded family life. Whereas the guys have wives, you know, so for them, piece of cake.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess if they find other things they want to do, but it's still very discouraging to look at the cover of Food and Wine, the top 10 chefs.
Oh, yeah, no, chefs. And every year they struggle to find a woman to put in there.
Yeah, well, they actually had two this year. I was really amazed.
No, it's good. It's good. It's just, it's not that women can't do it. We now know that women can be chefs and can run restaurants. Women can do anything. But it's just, it's a very hard life. If you're a chef owner, that's 100 hours a week.
Uh-huh.
You don't see your kids. You don't see, you know, your partner at home. And I think women have different priorities. Fame and glory is not really what drives them. They love cooking for people. They love feeding people. But they're not about to sacrifice the whole picture
now,
for just being a celebrity chef.
Now, why this book just now, Joyce?
Beg your pardon?
Why write this book now?
Well, I this was not my idea. University of California Press came to me and said, we think it's time that somebody did an overview of the development of California cuisine, and we think that you're the person to do it. And I had never written a history before. You know me, I've written 26 cookbooks, and I can write cookbooks pretty easily. But I thought, well, maybe I can do this. And it was a huge learning curve for me. I mean, getting the chronology straight, the importance of dates and sequencing of events. But I realized that people would talk to me because they knew me, and so that the interviews were really very rich, very full of information. People were very generous with their time and their story. But this was a huge project for me. It took 2.5 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's in small print, and it's got a lot of pages.
It was 700 pages before, so you can imagine. It was like a bloodbath cutting because, you know, as an author doing a history and you interview all these people, you want them in the book, and you can't get every single person in. And all these long quotes that you had become shorter quotes. That's part of the job of learning how to do this. If I ever do another history, I will be a little more adept.
Are you going to do a book, too, with all the leftover information that you have?
No. Once you do it, you do it. And now I'm sort of thinking about what my next project might be, and I haven't really homed in on yet. I've got a number of ideas that I'm playing with, but now, ready to make my move.
Yeah, it seems to me that if you have an interest in this whole area, if you have an interest in finding out why California now cooks the way it does, this is almost like mandatory reading. I mean, you ought to read it before you show up at one of Nancy Oakes' restaurants, or you ought to read it before you go to...
We should have a stack at the airport before you board the plane to come to California, read this book.
Exactly.
I mean, and you'll almost, thanks to the air traffic system, you'll almost have time.
But now, you've done all this research, and it was a huge learning curve, you said.
Yes.
Surely, as a result of all this, you probably, instead of just looking backwards and understanding what's happened, you probably have some pretty strong thoughts about what to look forward to and what's coming next.
Well, the thing is, I don't have a crystal ball. Mostly we're going to see a development of these themes that were started in the 70s and 80s. What we have now is just media overload. I mean, somebody sneezes and everybody all across the country hands them a Kleenex. You know, it's just the information gets out so fast. I think it's interesting to see whether this whole molecular gastronomy thing is going to fade away.
Oh, I think it's going.
I'm hoping it's going, yeah. But, you know, is traditional food going to be lost? Are we going to be eating multicultural fused foods forever? What will happen to traditional food? Will
insects,
anyone remember
Joyce.
What it was? I mean, this is one of my concerns.
What about insects? I mean, that seems to, every time I open an article of any sort, they're demonstrating the high protein content and all the social economic benefits of eating insects.
Well, I don't know. I don't have any recipes for those. What can I tell you? But it's hard to know where it's going to go. And my concern is that there are so few people cooking at home anymore. What will happen to America? I mean, will everybody be eating takeout? Will people be just giving up on this? I mean, we have all these wonderful farmers markets now and good ingredients, but certainly the chefs are supporting them. Some families are supporting them and doing some cooking at home. But what will it take to get Americans back in the kitchen?
Do you think that the social media wave of Twitter and Facebook, do you think that that's going to be helpful, or is it just going to be more noise?
I don't think it's going to be helpful getting people back in the kitchen. It just makes them frenzied about getting to every new place that opens and trying every new bar and trying every new cocktail and, you know, all this stuff. I mean, it's like it keeps the energy on a constant high, but there are people, you know, cooking really good food whom you never hear about because they're not doing outrageous things.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
a problem.
A lot of solid stuff gets ignored, you know, behind this facade of drama and competition.
Well, this one corporate chef asked me why one of his very best and most talented chefs never won any of the Beard Awards and, you know, all that stuff. And I thought about it, because this guy really is good. I said, Derek doesn't have tats.
Well, no, I mean, you've got to be a PR person. You've got to have a PR thing. You've got to be out there. You've got to be on TV. I mean, it's sort of a sad state of affairs that Americans are celebrity crazy and also fickle, because you can be a hit this week and a bum next week. You know, some other famous person comes in and knocks you off the slot. But I think it's made a lot of it very shallow.
I agree.
I worry, you know. I worry about real food and where it's going to go.
How much of this, the movement, if we call it that, how much of it was facilitated by the fact that there was also an extraordinarily fine and flourishing wine industry that was bringing more and more of a beverage to go along with this exciting new food?
Well, I think the food, the California cuisine movement and the California wine movement were interdependent. I mean, the fact that I can get in a car and be in the Napa Valley in an hour and 15 minutes and taste wine, and the fact that the winemakers can come down and eat in our restaurants and see how their wines are matching up with the kind of food that's being cooked, is very powerful. Also, it made wine and food pairing very natural in California. It wasn't some stilted thing that you had to learn, because we were all in it together. I think we've strengthened each other and continue to showcase each other's, but the restaurants showcase California wine, and the wineries hire California chefs to cook, to match with their wine. So it's been a wonderful symbiosis.
And let's not forget there's another member of the Goldstein family
who's had quite a lot
of influence along the way.
We like to work together. We still do a lot of, you know, food and wine pairing demos and classes and things, and we have a good time.
Now, the funny part about it, I met Evan for the first time, quite by accident. In fact, I finished up giving him a ride home from a restaurant called Wildwood in Portland, Oregon.
Oh, yes.
Because he actually went outside of California's boundaries.
He travels widely. Actually, we wish he'd stay home a little bit more. Just in the last 6 months, he's been to China, Korea, Portugal, Turkey, I don't know where else, but he's just been a whirling dervish, because wines all over the world interest him.
Well, I think he's made a great contribution. You've made a singular contribution. You've created a contribution yourselves, which we interviewed you about some time ago. And this is a can't put it down. Need to read what's on the next page.
I think we ought to get that in there, that Joyce, it's also so incredibly readable. And you just have such a nice light touch with some serious matters.
Thank you so much.
In fact, we're going to have to say goodbye, because we're going to have to go.
We're
going to have to go read some more pages.
Again, it's Joyce Goldstein, Inside the California Food Revolution, with a beautiful artichoke right on the cover. Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you so much, Anna Peter. It's lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, look forward to seeing you soon.
I hope so.
Thanks, Joyce.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with Molly Katzen right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Molly Katzen is legend. Most people would remember that she was the author of the Moosewood Cookbook, which really brought vegetarian food to center stage. She now has The Heart of the Plate, which is vegetarian recipes for a new generation. Welcomed on the menu, Molly.
Thank you so much.
You are a multifaceted, multi-talented woman. You also provide not only these absolutely amazingly meticulous recipes and with great flourishes of creativity, but you also do your own photography, your own line drawings, and other illustrations.
That's so much fun, though. To me, it's all connected, the visuals of the food and the visuals of the book.
Well, have you always just had those talents?
Always drawn pictures, and I've always loved to play in the kitchen, but actually the drawing part came first. That's something I did as a tiny child. Actually, I take it back. I cooked as a tiny child, too, but not in the kitchen. It was more like in the backyard, with dirt and mud and flowers and things.
Well, this is, as I said, an amazing book. Do you realize that everybody just thinks that you're the one that made vegetarian food respectable?
I don't always realize that. No, I feel like part of a continuum of, I stand on the shoulders of Frances Moore LePay and Anna Thomas,
oh,
who respectively wrote Diet for a Small Planet,
right,
and Vegetarian Epicure. Those books came before Moosewood and were a huge influence on me. So it's been kind of I consider us all collaborators over time.
Now, you mentioned before we came on the air that you don't produce a lot of cookbooks because they take a very long time.
Well, the way I work on them, they do.
How long was this one in process?
Well, from decision to actually do the book until it was handed into the printer, about 3 years. It's also a pretty large book for me. It's well over 250 recipes.
It is big. It's heavy.
Yeah, it weighs a lot. But, you know, each recipe is something I work on very specifically and repeatedly, so my kitchen becomes a lab. And I really do see a cookbook as a technical manual that is in a very friendly package, in a very friendly label, design, and friendly voice. But it is, at the end of the day, a technical manual, a how-to, which needs to be functional for people.
Now, there was a reason I asked that question, because it seems to me, as a dyed-in-the-wool carnivore, by the way, that the world of vegetarian eating has been changing very, very radically. And I'm wondering how much of a challenge that was that for you with a book that was 3 years in production and probably going to be another 6 months before it hit the bookshelves.
Well, my cooking evolved. My vegetarian cooking evolved over time, over, you know, several decades. And what I'm really trying to portray in this book is how I cook in my home now, you know, several decades post Moosewood Cookbook. I still cook out of the Moosewood Cookbook from time to time. Those recipes are still part of my repertoire. But what's happened is my cooking has become simpler. And it's partly just that I prefer to make a plate that's a juxtaposition of several different dishes that go beautifully together, but each one of those is a small, sort of almost, I call it like a single subject dish. Whereas once upon a time, I would have combined everything in a big bowl and added a bunch of beaten eggs and baked it in the oven so it would come out in squares or, you know, as a casserole, thinking more towards replacing the meat at the center of the plate. But now I'm thinking there doesn't really need to be a center of the plate. It can be a collaborative plate. So I make several smaller dishes that are simpler, and they go side by side. And it's visually a lot more fun that way. It's more playful and more unpredictable. No. But it's also possible to do this because ingredients are so much better now.
Oh, yes.
So a tomato in season or a bell pepper, a sweet bell pepper in season, they're so delicious, just completely plain. That it almost makes my job too easy. You need to do very little to it.
It seems, though, and this is one of the points that I was hoping you'd emphasize, but I'm sure you can now you know I was thinking about it, that veganism has been growing, it seems, leaps and bounds across that 3.5-year time span. And you've done an excellent job in saying, now, you can make this recipe vegan. All you have to do is take out ingredient A, possibly add ingredient B, or just leave it out altogether.
That's true. I like to present, I'm not a proponent of veganism, nor I'm not even a proponent of the kind of vegetarianism that is a statement against eating meat. That's not my position, and it's not my goal to get people to stop eating animal products, but I do want to give people options for eating completely plant-based meals a lot of the time. And so if the basic plate is mostly vegan, that means that we start with a plate that a vegan can totally enjoy, that a vegetarian who also might be someone who eats eggs and cheese, a lacto-ovo, as they call it, could also enjoy that same plate either as is or by adding in some very tasty cheese, a little bit of that crumbled, or a beautifully fried egg. I have a lovely little recipe for eggs that are fried in olive oil-coated breadcrumbs, or egg noodles, which is literally noodles made out of a very thin omelet sliced into thin strips. And a meat lover can join that meal, too, eating it as is or with the vegetarian toppings, or even with, if you have a little bit of meat left over from last night and you want to slice it thin and make it use it as a garnish or a topping, that same vegan plate could be made meat lover friendly if that meat lover wants meat at that meal. But my overall point is that I would love for the person who identifies as vegan and the person who identifies as vegetarian and then the person who just loves food and doesn't identify as anything can all sit down together at the same table and just enjoy themselves, just have a delicious, fun time without all the speeches about who eats what and why.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these recipes are really too delicious to be labeled vegetarian.
Well, that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping they won't be labeled at all. Or, if it's labeled, that the vegetarian part is simply a descriptor of the food and not of the person. It's not a noun. It's not the person. It is an adjective. It describes the food. That opens things up for people. It keeps it a lot more fluid, which is how I like.
Now, once upon a time, I had a relative who visited my sister. And he was vegetarian, and every time he went there, all he got was bulgur wheat, because it was the only vegetarian recipe that my sister had. Now, I'm making a point here. The point is that the range of dishes that you offer is so vast. You can't say, well, it's easy to make a vegetarian main course. It's probably fairly hard. It's certainly harder to make a vegetarian dessert. It's not as hard to make a vegetarian soup. But you've got all of these in chapters devoted to them.
Absolutely. I love variety, and there is so much variety. When you are in the plant food realm, it is just unlimited, really, what you can do with the different kinds of grains, the different kinds of legumes. Just even under the lentil category alone, I've been finding 4, 5, 6 different kinds of lentils you can work with, different colors. And in the kale category, you know, kale is now the superstar of vegetables. In the 90s, never dreamed that would be the case.
I have no idea why. I mean, I was raised on it, so it's not really unusual to me.
I know. I've been cooking kale for decades, but people used to find it kind of odd. People also used to find Brussels sprouts used to be kind of a punchline, and now they're kind of worshipped. But that's fine with me. But the different varieties, just the purple kale and the green kale, or with the different colored peppers. I know I live in California, and the variety I am blessed to be able to choose from is greater than maybe in other parts of the country. But it's catching up everywhere, and it's wonderful.
But think back to when you came out first with started writing about food. You wouldn't even be able to get half of these ingredients, and people probably looked at you oddly.
Oh, yes.
And
I was the one always making what we called crunchy granola.
Oh, yeah.
And I really did make granola all the time in the early 70s, and my friends would roll their eyes up. Oh, she's going to make us eat this granola. And I was out there. I was so alone. I had some friends, and I had some very tolerant friends, but I've been obsessed with this kind of food for a very long time.
And did anybody ever ask you what got you into this?
Oh, I've asked that all the time. It's just with a sense of adventure and fun around food, and also a personal quest, very unofficial for a number of years, and then it became more official, a quest for just unusual, and not crazy unusual, but just interesting and unusual ways to cook meals that were based on vegetables. I had a passion for vegetables from a very early age. I really didn't come to it from any kind of dogma or antipathy towards meat. However, I did come from a kosher home, and so meat was in its own category. A meat meal was a certain kind of meal that never included any dairy product. And meat also was something that had to be proven. It had to meet a certain standard always in my upbringing because the kosher kind of requirement. And so I did grow up with a sense right out of the gate that meat was guilty until proven innocent. Again, it wasn't, my cooking didn't end up being a statement about meat. Moreover, what the main thing that was going on is that I was in love with the foods we had on the night off for meat. Once a week we have what we call dairy night, because if it wasn't meat, it was dairy. Mm-hmm. It wasn't vegetarian, it was dairy. And on that night we would have such interesting things. We'd have kugels and salads and little casseroles. My mom always made too much food on those nights.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're not having the meat, you're going to die on the spot from malnutrition. So, but I loved the variety when we had meat, there was no variety. It was just a hunk of meat, maybe a little side dish or two, but very incidental. But on the nights when we didn't have meat, that was when it got really interesting.
Now, we had a guest on just a few months ago who wrote a book, and she insisted it wasn't called a vegetarian cookbook, it was a vegetable cookbook. So she was creating recipes with vegetables because she thought vegetables were just really good. And,
exactly.
And you seem to almost have a similar point of view in a way.
I do. I have a very similar point of view, but I keep, especially in this book, I keep my recipes completely meat-free. So I know there are some vegetable books that might have a little bit of bacon or ham for flavoring or chicken stock. I happen to personally love anchovies. But I've kept all of that out of this book because I want the baseline of this book to be absolutely vegetarian-friendly so that people who really don't want completely 100% pure plant food can trust that in this book they can just relax and that they will be in good hands.
Yeah.
We want to add in some animal products are free to do that, but I want to make it absolutely smooth and trustworthy to the most devoted plant-only person.
And you have a black bean, a Cuban black bean recipe in here, and I used to make black bean soup with a ham hock, and my Cuban sort of relative used to be absolutely appalled because it's supposed to be a vegetarian dish.
No, it is. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
In the United States, it's not a vegetarian
no,
dish.
No, but it's supposed to be.
One of the things that when dishes are cooked with ham hock or with bacon or things like that, very often it's to get a smoky layer, a layer of a certain kind of smoky flavor. And there are many other ways to do that now that don't include ham hock or bacon.
Yeah, how do you do it? Because I just had an interesting dish with smoked peanuts in it in the South.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Well, if you want a layer of smoke in your cooking, there's a couple things you can do. We have a kind of a list of choices. One is you can use a smoked paprika.
Right.
A pimenton that's smoked. And that can
we
be very
just
effective.
Had that last night.
They're not all equal. Some are smokier than others. You can also, if you don't mind a bit of heat, you can go to a chipotle powder. Because a chipotle chile is it's a jalapeno that's been smoked and dried. So you can add a touch of that. With that, you'll get some heat. You could also use, they have now smoked olive oils, which are incredible, and you can find those online. You can also smoked salt with all the different designer salts available, smoked salt, and there's many different kinds of that. A drop of liquid smoke, that's not my favorite kind. I prefer the smoked olive oil or the smoked salt. But the other thing is I don't think too many people will want to do this choice, but you can also just not wash your pans all that often. And you know, if you keep your pan a little crusted, if it's one of those well-loved, quote-unquote, pans, the unwashed pan is another route to a smoky flavor.
As long as it wasn't just used for cooking bacon.
Exactly.
Now, our listeners, Molly, love what I call, but it's not quite food porn, but they like details. Can you pick a dish and just describe it, what it tastes like, maybe two dishes from the book?
What it tastes like
how it's made.
One of them, I was going to pick asparagus, but they're not complete. They're not officially in season right now. Would you rather have asparagus?
That's okay. No, it doesn't matter.
I'd love to do this with asparagus. This is a cold asparagus dish, a salad-like dish, and one of the things that is a tricky tightrope in cooking green vegetables and wanting them to be deeply marinated, say in a vinaigrette, is that on the one hand you want that flavor to have time and to sort of infuse the vegetable. You want soaking up the flavor time. However, in a vinaigrette, a lot of that flavor comes from the acid of the vinegar. Sometimes it also has some lemon juice in it, but there's the presence of acid, and acid is it's both good and bad. The good is obvious. It's a beautiful kind of sparkle up for any kind of vegetable. So it really brightens the flavor, but it leaches the chlorophyll out of any green vegetable.
Uh-huh.
So a green vegetable that sits in a vinaigrette for too long is going to become faded out and lose its color.
Right.
But we also want to soak up this asparagus. So my solution to that is that I soak the steamed asparagus. It's called gingered asparagus with soy caramel.
No, I was looking at
and
that
one. And I let the cooked asparagus steep in an oil and garlic and ginger kind of combination. It infuses it's like garlic and ginger spiked oil. And it sits and soaks that up deliciously with just some salt. And then at serving time, I spoon on a soy caramel, which you can make far in advance. One of those sauces that you just kind of simmer on the stove. You put everything in the pot and let it kind of cook down a little bit, and it gets all syrupy and deliciously caramelly. And that is a combination of soy sauce with some sweetener. I use agave nectar for that, some garlic, and more ginger, in lemon juice. I cook it down into a syrup, so it's a soy caramel. And just before serving time, I'll drizzle that on top of that garlic and ginger-soaked asparagus.
Wow.
And I like to keep the asparagus in long lengths so that it's not all chopped up. It's slightly thick spears, and they make this beautiful platter. And serve it at room temperature. And it's a very mysterious dish because is it a salad? Maybe. Is it a side dish? Yes. You could serve it with poached eggs or with marinated tofu, and it becomes a little main dish on rice. It's a beautiful thing. So I love that. And so I recommend this highly. And then another thing that I love very much, I have a stew chapter, and each stew has a hat. Accessory.
I was kind of curious about that.
Yeah, well, I just think a bowl of stew is fine, but it becomes a lot more fun when it has a kind of playful accessory that is a textural contrast to it. So the stew that I love to describe in more detail for you, it's a kimchi stew.
It's
straight out of a jar. You know, you can choose the mild or the hot. Of course, I go for the hot. And stew is very forgiving. You know, you put it on the stove and let it cook and cook, and you don't worry about it too much. And this one has bean thread noodles, that kind of cellophane noodles that you get in the Asian food store, and quite a bit of onions cooked down with shiitake mushrooms and tofu and regular mushrooms and cabbage. I like to use a Savoy cabbage, the kind of ruffled leaf. And I make that into a stew with the little, it's so beautiful with the cellophane noodles peeking through, and the kimchi kind of dots it with little pieces of red chili, makes it spicy. And the mushrooms have an amazing texture. It's just one of my favorite stews. And then the hat for it is crisped noodles.
That's what those are. Okay.
Yeah, if you take a rice noodle, Asian rice noodle, the skinny kind, you can puff it like popcorn in hot oil on the stove, and it makes these ethereal little noodle puffs like magic. And you put these crunchy things on this kimchi stew, and I personally would wash it down with a nice beer. That would be my taste.
I'm looking at it, and I want it right now.
Oh, me too.
Oh, dear. Oh,
make someone mail it over, would you?
Oh, absolutely. At your service.
Well, I think that this is a genius book. I think that I wish you lots of luck with it. I can't imagine why everybody wouldn't run out and buy it.
Oh,
and
you're my best friend. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and give it as a gift for the holidays in some sort.
Well, thank you.
Yes. Anyhow, again, it's The Heart of the Plate, Molly Katzen, Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation, and by golly, it's delicious, huh?
And we'll see you in 3 years with another book.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that.
Okay. Molly, thank
you.
So that's this week's program.
Yeah, I hope everybody really enjoys it, because I had such a good time talking to these three women who I admire so much.
So do I. And I felt a little bit on the outside, but that's all right. I deserve it anyway. So join us again, same time, same place next week, when we'll have more exciting On the Menu adventures. And in the meantime, until then,
bye-bye.